So in a debate, I'm trying to use whatever one has said and get the other to respond, not just to say mean things about the guy who spoke.
It sounds a little like
him.
A playground. Did you hear what he said?
Yeah. Yeah.
From First Look Media and Panoply, this is Politically Reactive. I'm W. Kamau Bell.
And I'm Ladies Love Cool Hari Kundabolu.
Are you?
Yeah.
Okay. The show where two comedians try to make sense of politics in America.
We're currently comedians, but soon enough they'll call us public intellectuals. I'm not going to stop that campaign. Come on, NPR. Come on, New York Times. Come on, Washington Post. Intellectualize us.
So obsessed. Today we're talking to host of CBS's Face the Nation and author of the New York Times bestseller Whistle Stop, John Dickerson.
He moderated a Democratic and Republican debate this campaign cycle, so we'll ask him the hard-hitting questions, like which party runs over their time the most and which candidate loves America the least.
And who has the biggest flag pen? Also, we'll ask him what it feels like to get booed by Ted Cruz supporters.
Well, we have 80 years of precedent of not confirming Supreme Court justices in an election year.
But Kennedy was confirmed in 88.
No, Kennedy was confirmed in 87.
He was appointed in 88. That's the question. Is it appointing or confirming? What's the difference?
In this case, it's both, but if I could answer
the
question.
Sorry, I just want to get the facts straight for the audience. I apologize.
Boo! Facts! How dare you mention facts?
Man, that reminds me. I really don't miss Ted Cruz.
The Washington Post once wrote this about his interviewing style. His colleagues have coined the term for cleverly worded, seemingly harmless, but incisive questions. Dickersonian. Good work, colleagues.
After 9/11, what would your biggest mistake be, would you say, and what lessons have you learned from it?
I wish you'd have given me this written question ahead of time so I could plan for it.
Oh, come on, George. We all know reading wasn't exactly your strong suit.
Remember when we thought George W. Bush was definitely going to be the worst president of all time and there was no way he would be topped? Simpler times. Come on, are you crying?
Yes.
Don't worry. Armageddon will happen soon enough. We'll all be done for.
That is comforting.
It's all coming up on Politically Reactive.
Hey, Hari, how's it going?
Man, it's going great, man. I was profiled in Morning Edition this morning. My hot progressive rating has gone through the roof again. This is a big one, man. This is as big as when I got into that sexy Asian men calendar earlier this year. This is pretty big.
It's the objectification of Hari. That's what's happening right
now. Oh, man. I haven't been objectified this much since like 2009, man. I'm back, baby. Hari's back.
Ladies of Bumble, get ready.
I'm off that. I'm not going back on that. I'm done with that. Mm-hmm. It's over.
Okay.
I'm healthy.
Okay. Sounds like what Anthony Weiner said at one point.
Yeah,
anyway.
Yeah. Who do we have on the show today?
Today's show, we have the awesome John Dickerson. He's the host of CBS News' Face the Nation. And like me, he believes that a man can't have too many podcasts. He's on Whistle Stop. He's on Political Gab Fest. He's got a Face the Nation podcast. And Whistle Stop has turned into a best-selling New York Times book that we highly encourage you to go out and read. The podcast is great. It's all about unknown and little-known presidential and election history. It's super good. He's great. He knows what he's doing.
He was a great guest. He put up with my nonsense.
He did, and you really threw a lot of nonsense at him. I got to be clear about that.
I threw some nonsense at him. I think that's friendly.
The nonsense was strong that day is all I'm saying.
I mean, we could have podcast rivals. We can goof around a little bit. It's friendly. It's a friendly rivalry that he didn't know existed until he walked into the room.
So, yeah, this was recorded in Philly during the DNC on July 26th. And with all the craziness going on at the DNC, we just wanted to talk to John Dickerson about what it's like to moderate debates. He's an expert in presidential history, so we talked a little bit about that. And Hari sort of insulted him several times, but it was fun.
I mean, he was a good sport about it, I think.
I was like, Hari, we've invited company over. He's a big deal.
He's
a big guest. And I mean, he's the first person we've had on who's like legitimately a member of mainstream media. No offense, Van Jones, but you're a communist.
But it, Some people don't know that is a joke,
and we're
going to get some tweets and like, no, no, listen to the few episodes back.
Also, in last week's episode, we had a little Easter egg in there. It was me and my friend Adam Mansback. He's the writer of the upcoming film Barry, about a year in the life of Barack Obama when he was in college at Columbia. And we did a little thing where we read a bit of our piece that was in Salon several months ago, where we basically told white people, go get Donald Trump. And out of that piece came the hashtag whites against Trump. And last week when we brought that up again, a lot of you guys out there started tweeting hashtag whites against Trump, a way for white people to use their white privilege for good instead of just like returning things to stores that they shouldn't be returning to that store.
So let's get hashtag whites against Trump trending on Twitter again during this next debate. It's September 26th, hashtag whites against Trump.
And we have some great guests coming up. We have Rosa Clemente coming up. She's going to talk to us all about the Green Party. And we also have a super surprise awesome guest. She is amazing. You're going to be very excited. And we're not going to tell you who she is. You're just going to have to wait.
Mm-hmm.
On that note, time for John Dickerson. It's about to get Dickersonian up in here. We are here with John Dickerson from Face the Nation and 1,000 Podcasts.
And now a new one. I'm now, you know, crawling into a new one.
Yeah. I mean, we joke on the show. I actually have 3 podcasts myself, so I'm glad to see somebody else feel like you can't just have 1 podcast at a time.
Yeah, now I need to get a 4th.
Yeah,
I'm feeling a little threatened.
We're both on Panoply, so I'm here taking your spot, John.
Yes, I've noticed you're taking my spot in the rankings too. Or someone told me, I'm sure.
I'm not
familiar with those iTunes rankings.
None of us pay attention to iTunes. We don't open and see if we can see our logos and faces.
Yeah.
You're at CBS, though. Do the people at CBS, are they completely confused about what you're doing? Like, what is this podcast?
Well, they're confused about what I'm doing just generally because I'm confusing. No, actually, it's been great. I one of the podcasts I do is something called the Face the Nation Diary, which is short, informal takes on whatever's happening in the news that day. It's the kind of thing that I would write normally, but I would need about an hour and a half more to write it. So I just say it. So yeah. They were incredibly adaptive, which was great because after the 2 Whistle Stop and the Gabfest that I do for Panoply, that's the way I start to think now. So it was actually quite easy getting it together for them.
And we're ahead of all 3 of them?
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
Larry, you are.
You are. I love the way you said that in that as if you were wondering. You know? Are we? Is that right? I can't tell. You did like it was like a modified caveman lawyer. What is this strange, this computation you have? Yeah. Rankings.
I can't believe you just mentioned unfrozen caveman lawyer. Yeah. That's good.
Like you wanted him to, John, could you pull up your phone and see, are we ahead of all 3 of your podcasts?
Could someone Google that? Because I can't, I'm not sure.
You're going to show up on Sunday on Face Nation. We're going to be like, hey, what's up, John? How's it going?
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. Could you get out of my seat, please?
So let's talk about this because this is, 21st century media is different than 20th century media. And you're the host of a very established 20th century media show, Face the Nation. I would imagine that when you maybe looked at that show from afar as you've been sort of in political reporting all your life, it seems, from your mom through you, that you looked at that show as a very different show than that show exists today.
Yeah, well, especially since I grew up watching it. And, my mom, who's a journalist, was the kind of person who would sit with a pen and pad and watch the Sunday shows and take notes. And, it's interesting the way in the old days where, there were 2.5 channels, really. And the Sunday show was was super formal. It has the same format now, but it isn't as formal. The questions weren't as hard-hitting as they are now. And It played a different role in the diet. I think it's still now we think of it at the end of a crazy week where all kinds of things are happening. It's the place to come for context. Back then, it was a place to go to see figures. I mean, now the way politics work, they aren't doing it the same. It wouldn't work the same way as in 1960.
Yeah, because I mean, I would imagine back then the sense was, I've never seen this person really talk this way before.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And oftentimes they didn't know how to talk with a camera around. There are all of these. There's all this great footage of them staring off into the distance because they didn't know where the camera was, and then like swiveling around in their chair because they didn't know what it was like to be on camera. So that's right. It was just a totally different kind of both news environment and also just show an animal in the world.
I mean, you've moderated presidential debates. What does it take to be a good moderator? What do you think is like the ideal kind of thing you should be aiming for?
I'll tell you what I thought before and then what I think now. They're roughly the same thing. But my view is that the ones who are really good are a window pane, which is to say that voters see the candidates through you, but you're not in the way, you know, going like, look at me with my fancy question, or look at me interrupting all the time. Or, but on the other hand, your job is to be a window pane that is clear, which is to say you're not occluding the conversation with some questions that's confusing or something that's off base or something that, particularly when you're doing primaries, if you're doing a primary in a given party, there's no point in asking a question where every candidate is going to agree with each other because that's the party orthodoxy. So there are a lot of times people say, why didn't they talk about climate change in a Republican primary debate? Because there's no difference between the candidates. And the point of a primary debate is to illuminate the differences between the candidates to help the people voting in the primary have a, you know, figure out what the differences are. In a general election, the topic area changes. So that's what I thought beforehand, and I thought you basically have to work really hard beforehand in getting up to speed on the issues. And the reason is sort of twofold, and I'm not sure where I come down on this exactly, but one, you want to know how to ask the question that's right at the margin of the talking points, which is to say you don't want to just give them a format to just say the same thing over again. You're trying to get distinctions between the candidates, A, so that voters can make a choice, but B, so you illuminate the tension in any given issue. Like, what are the trade-offs? What are the sacrifices? What are the constraints on what you're offering? You have to do a lot. In my case, because I came up through the print world, I just did lots and lots of interviews. So I interviewed experts on every single topic, talked to the campaigns, figured out what their policies were. To try to be able to ask questions that get, you know, that sort of get at that friction point, not friction in terms of controversy or conflict, but friction in terms of like, where is the public conversation? Where does it need to go on this given issue? Then the other thing you have to do is just figure out so that when they say something, you can illuminate it by asking another question of somebody else, or in other words, you're not just letting them give their talking points. And then the thing that I still don't, you know, that I'm new at is how to manage it in a way so that you're keeping the conversation on the rails, but on the other hand, you're not interrupting so much and you're not getting in the way of giving them a chance to display themselves in their full glory. Sometimes their glory is, you know,
not so full.
Yeah. Sometimes it's a little too full.
They get burned on their own glory.
Right. Yeah.
And I will tell you, it's three agencies of government when I get there that are gone: commerce, education, and the, what's the third one there? Let's see.
I mean, I think it's interesting, like, you know, the talking points, you generally know what direction they're going to go in, unless they stumble, like, you know what to follow up with. What do you do with Trump? None of us know where he's going to go or what he's going to say. And he might say one thing in the beginning, and by the end of it, he says the opposite.
Right. So it depends whether it's in a debate or in an interview format. In a debate, you know, the idea is really to get the candidates debating. So it's not a serial set of interviews. So in a debate, I'm trying to use whatever one has said and get the other to respond, not just to say mean things about the guy who spoke.
It sounds a little like a playground. Do you hear what he said?
Yeah. So that's the worst thing you can do, right? Which is like,
you don't let him say that, Ted Cruz?
Exactly. Joe said this about you. Yeah. You're not positive. You can't let that stand. That,
and backstage, you mentioned your wife.
Right.
Hey, hurry.
Yeah.
Since we're talking about politicians acting like children, here's a classic clip from CNN of Donald Trump getting into it at a town hall meeting with Anderson Cooper.
After saying that you were going to spill the beans about Heidi Cruz, you retweeted an unflattering picture of her next to a picture of your wife.
I thought it was a nice picture of Heidi. I thought it was fine.
Come on.
I thought it was fine. She's a pretty woman.
You're running for president of the United States.
Excuse me. I didn't start it.
Oh, that's,
I didn't start it.
But, sir, with all due respect, that's the argument of a five-year-old.
I didn't start it. No, it's not the,
yeah,
no, it's
the argument of a five-year-old is he started it.
You would say that. That's the problem with our country.
Every parent knows
that's
a kid
not
who
a five-year-old.
Says he started
Excuse me.
It.
Oh, my God. Is Congress allowed to give the president a timeout? Is that a thing that's going to happen?
At some point, Paul Ryan's going to be like, President Trump, here's your blankie. Now go take a nap. Okay, back to John.
Because that doesn't tell anybody anything. That just gets them into a, like, personal feud. But if you can say, in our debate, I asked Donald Trump about, you know, he had said that George Bush lied the country into war and should be impeached for it. So George Bush was campaigning for his brother in South Carolina at the time. Where the candidates stand on national security is shaped by the Iraq experience.
So you still think he should be impeached?
I think it's my turn, isn't it?
You do whatever you want. You call it whatever you want. I want to tell you. They lied.
Okay.
They said there were weapons of mass destruction. There were none. And they knew there were none. There were no weapons of mass destruction.
Okay. All right. Governor Bush. When a member on the stage's brother gets attacked,
I got
brother
about
gets
five
to
or
respond.
Six. Do I get to do it five or six times or just once
nice.
Responding to that?
So I was trying to get, you know, that's a pretty strong thing for a guy to say, especially when his brother is standing on stage. So that had a personal element, of course, but it's also like what you think about Iraq and whether it was a good intervention and what it unleashed is basically the centerpiece of a lot of foreign policy thinking in both parties. So trying to build on what everybody thought about that, you try to get them having a conversation and then you let it and then you let them do their talking. Because if it's a conversation, it's not a talking point because you don't usually – talking points are formed for speeches. But if it's an interaction, it's harder to give a talking point in an interaction, one hopes.
Unless you're Marco Rubio when you use your talking points as conversation.
And let's dispel once and for all with this fiction that Barack Obama doesn't know what he's doing. He knows exactly what he's doing. But I would add this. Let's dispel with this fiction that Barack Obama doesn't know what he's doing. He knows exactly what he's doing. Facts. Here's the bottom line. This notion that Barack Obama doesn't know what he's doing is just not
there
true.
There it is.
He knows exactly what he's doing.
There it is. The memorized 25-second speech.
Well, that's
there it
the
is, everybody.
Exactly. And but but.
Oh, that's how you do it.
Yeah,
that's Dickersonian right there. Yeah, and but I've read about that.
Right. Yes. And but or and so. You know, that illuminated something, which was – and Chris Christie made sure everybody knew it at the time, which is that he was that he'd come with a script and that he wasn't. Now, then you can evaluate whether being fast on your feet in a debate is an important attribute for a president to have. And you can argue that one kind of either way.
I mean, I feel like in history, maybe not, but in the 21st century, absolutely.
Yeah.
Like, but even going back to like the Lincoln-Douglas debates.
Hold up. Wait a minute.
The Lincoln-Douglas debates, also known as the Great Debates of 1858, were seven debates between Abraham Lincoln, who was running for Senate in Illinois, and Stephen Douglas, who was the incumbent Democratic senator. Illinois was a free state, but most of the debates centered around slavery, and it put Lincoln into the national spotlight even though he ultimately lost his bid for Senate. And as we all know, he was never heard from again.
Wait a minute, hold up.
You're saying it wrong.
Yeah, I had to break in here, Hari, because I got some breaking news for you. Abraham Lincoln actually became president of the United States 3 years later, and then actually signed the Emancipation Proclamation, which freed the slaves in the southern states, and he's actually regarded as one of America's greatest presidents.
Oh, for real?
Yeah, man, yeah.
Oh, shit, no wonder he's on the penny.
Yeah. That New York public school education is not what it's cracked up to be.
Man.
Yeah. Sorry, man. Take a knee. Wasn't there a sense that, like, you know, that one was faster on his feet than the other one?
Yeah. I mean, there was, although in the Lincoln-Douglas debates, they got to talk for long patches, and then they'd switch over. But the other thing about the Lincoln-Douglas debates, just to go off on that brief side road, is at times Lincoln acted like a baby. He was complaining. They had to, like, he tried to, like, walk out on the stage while Douglas was talking. I mean, he doesn't come across as the guy who's just got the world by the tail and is totally – I mean, he's clever and he makes lots of jokes, but he's not just crushing it at every time, at least based on the – there's an audiobook of the – and Richard Dreyfuss plays Douglas, and it's great to listen to, but there's – you know, Lincoln's a little – he's a little a little jumpy.
A little jumpy.
Yeah.
We just breaking news here. Lincoln, jumpy. my question about – one more question about the debate, because you had a moment with – which I'm sure you've talked about ad infinitum with Ted Cruz at the debate, where you basically just – it's not even that you really fact-checked him. You just wanted to be clear about what he was saying.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't even his full-on fact. It was like, can I just be clear about what you're saying?
Right.
And the Cruzomaniacs had feelings about that.
They did. They booed me. Yes. That was a good way to start the debate.
How did you feel? I mean, you know, because you're not expecting, as you said, you're trying to be a window pane, and suddenly there was mud on your window pane.
Right, right. And you're thinking, oh, my God, did I put it there? And then and it was early. Yeah. It was the first set of questions. And you've got, you know, so you're standing there and you've got, I don't know, 600, 800 people at your back. So you can't see them. None of the social cues are there. All you just hear is they're booing you. So what happened was, so Justice Scalia died about an hour and a half before we were supposed to go on stage. And everything when we'd spent weeks and weeks coming up with these questions and making sure they were fair, making sure they were illuminating the right things, making sure that we had the right kinds of questions. We spent a lot of time thinking about this. So when something breaks in the end, as it did with Paris, the attack in Paris happened 24 hours before our Democratic debate. We basically had to tear everything up and redo it. And then this happened again. At first reaction was, why does this keep happening to us? But then we had to throw out our first line of questionings, come up with a new line of questionings about the Scalia replacement and not just, you know, he's passed away. What do you think? That doesn't tell anybody anything. Right?
Yeah. Because you're going to get that's leading them right into their talking points.
Right.
Great man, blah, blah, blah.
Right. So we spent an hour, you know, my colleagues and I calling up people. I called up some people I know who cover the Supreme Court and others and emailed a bunch of people and said, like, what's the question? What do we want to know? And we got into this question of when have presidents – what's the precedent here in terms of presidents naming a justice and then having one confirmed and appointed? So there was a timeline question of whether a president had ever had one confirmed in this space before the end of a term – the end of a president's term. So in the back, we were just debating this all the time. Like, wait, what's the precedent? Is it right here? And then there's some confusion. So when I went out to ask the questions, I was in that mode. I was in the, like, wait, is it this or it's that? Like, desperate to find out where the line was in terms of previous presidents. And so when Cruz gave what turned out to be an inaccurate representation of what Reagan had done.
What? Ted Cruz?
I was really still sort of in the backstage mode thinking, like, but wait, wasn't it that he named him but wasn't not? Anyway, it was on behalf of the audience to try to just illuminate exactly what the precedent was. But the audience thought I was being too prosecutorial, so they booed.
Are you kind of dead in the water at that point? Because do they already assume liberal media with their liberal media questions?
That's a worry. I mean, and also you have no – you know, there's the dynamic behind you is you have 200 representatives or 200 fans of each candidate. They're there to yell and holler as loud as possible to make it look like whatever their candidate has said has been the greatest answer in the world. So it's already a pretty exciting environment. And I mean, I kind of thought, OK, we'll see how this goes, because the questions we're going to ask, none of them are going to be, you know, what did you have for lunch today, or how great are you?
Or tell me, how much do you love the flag? Yeah. Thanks for asking the question, John.
Yeah. And the only thing I think that saved me, I mean, there was no more booing. There was a lot of raucous yelling because, again, when your candidate answers, you want to make it sound like the whole hall has erupted in.
Like the Beatles on Sullivan. Oh,
yeah. Yeah, so that the folks at home think, wow, I love this new band despite their haircuts. And so the folks at home think, you know, you're trying to basically fool them, because if your candidate's at 1%, you got to, like, This is the only instance in which there's a level playing field. So what saved me, though, is because I didn't think of it as an interview, I wasn't pressing the candidates as much as I would during an interview. So there were fewer opportunities later to get into that kind of fast back and forth, which would have created the conditions for more booing, which isn't to say that I didn't press the candidates, but it's not. It was a little bit more elongated, and so everybody was fine by the end. And by the end, there were lots of lots of people came up to me and said nice things. So we won them over in the end.
We've talked about dog whistling on the show, and I know that's the conversation you've had as well. How does George Wallace compare to Trump? Is that a fair comparison? Because we've made that on the show before.
For more information about dog whistling and why Governor George Wallace was the worst, listen to the first episode of Politically Reactive. This is just a way to get us more downloads.
So Wallace in 68, when he talked about Law and Order,
not the show.
Yes, right. The show did not exist.
With our listeners, they may be like, George Wallace talked about the show Law and Order?
Special Victims Unit.
Yes.
So
Special Racist Unit.
Hold up, wait a minute.
Okay, everybody. This cutaway is not really for any good reason. It's just Hari really wants to tell you about how much he loves the TV show Law & Order.
I really love Law & Order, both the original series as well as SVU. Criminal Intent isn't really good, but I really like Vincent D'Onofrio. He's so weird in it that I find it enjoyable. Definitely Mariska Hargitay.
Sound engineer Ted, Maloney, can you fade Hari out so we can get the hell out of this nightmare?
They were such a good team.
And yeah, that's good. No, a little bit more. A little bit more. There we go.
Oh, by the way, Jill Hennessy follows me on Twitter.
Jesus, how the hell did he turn himself back up?
Jill Hennessy.
So Wallace in 68, when he talked about Law & Order, so there's a big debate still. I mean, I think historians generally, look, he was a segregationist. So there's not like, you know, there's no, it's pretty clear what he felt. His argument about a Law & Order was linked to both busing legislation and the, you know, moving people and their kids in particular. One of his ads is a school bus with a bunch of kids pressed up against the back window, and the bus is driving away as your kids are being bused across town.
Why are more and more millions of Americans turning to Governor Wallace? Follow as your children are bused across town.
As president, I shall, within the law, turn back the absolute control of the public school systems to the people of the respective states.
It was clearly to consolidate white voters worried about the cities. And so he was, it's pretty clear what he was trying to do. With Donald Trump, it's different. Whatever is in his heart, it is clear that there's a racial element to his Law & Order pitch. And it excites the same responses. You can see it just in social media, that people will take a conversation about Law & Order and go right to race. Like, nobody said anything about race at all. They will go there immediately. And that's not just because it's not a candidate's intent. We've lived with that connection now for, 50 years. So the historical dog whistle is there. And so if you're using that language, you got to know that's what's going to happen at some level.
That's fascinating, just the idea that there is a numerical component to dog whistling. You can actually find out how effective your dog whistle is, like looking on Twitter or Facebook or whatever else.
Well, and I just see it in comments that I get on Facebook where, somebody the other day that was just their first reaction. This was a defender of Donald Trump's. It just went right to race. One of the things they found in 1968, the surprise of Wallace, who was very much like Trump in the sense that people thought like, oh, he's this fringe kind of figure. Some people thought that Johnson had convinced him to get in the race to split the Republican vote. They found that the places that Wallace had the most support were in those districts or counties right next to the African-American districts in cities in the north, because these were the people who felt the most physical threat from the African-American. And there's also an economic piece to it, too. Rising African-American middle class was threatening certain kinds of jobs for blue-collar workers. Plus, you had a peace. So the other piece of it, though, is you have the peace marchers and demonstrators. You had a lot of unrest in the cities we don't have now. And so Wallace could be talking about, communists, hippies. He could be talking about a lot of stuff when he was talking about Law & Order, which allowed him to be successful in using that language and not get pinned down.
I have one more debate question before we go forward, because I think when I think about that moment and with Ted Cruz, and I'm not trying to make too much out of it, but I think about that moment, like I always watch debates. And I feel like a lot of people on Twitter do this too, where they wish somebody was like, that there was a sense like of keeping score or of like buzzing in. We're like, that's not factually correct. You know, like, and I feel like when that moment you had with him, it's like, it wasn't even like you were like being rude. You were just going, you need to clarify your point. And yet you got hit. Shouldn't debates be more holding people to the fire?
Yeah.
Well, as far as facts and rhetorical flourishes are one thing, but you know what I mean? But like actually holding people to the fire with their facts.
I think you get, So it's a couple of things. I think you want to. So in that case, I was trying to just set the terms for the conversation,
like high school debate.
Yeah, yeah. What are the facts that were? Let's agree on the facts, and then you can have your opinion and decide what you think. So that's slightly different than when somebody says something and they say something that's not factually accurate. Mm-hmm. The tricky thing about that in a debate is, the clock is ticking. You got to give equal time to both. The issues you're talking about are super complex if you're doing it right, which means you've got to, in a very short period of time, explain the context of why what they've gotten is wrong, be right that you fact-checked them.
Yeah, yeah.
And also sometimes it's not super close. You know, it's not precisely the you know, sometimes it's they're purposely saying something that's not right. Sometimes they've gotten it a little wrong. Sometimes they're mangling the context. You got to do all of that and not steal time from the candidates. We all want that, but it would be a different kind of debate. Also, I think it's incumbent upon the challenger to do that. I mean, this is a contest between two people, and you know, because what that would then do is keep debates from being basically stump speeches in parallel. If we felt and we all agreed that it was the responsibility of Donald Trump to fact check Hillary Clinton or vice versa, then you know, when the fact checking happens, you're suddenly having an actual debate. Mm-hmm. You're not like it's not a debate between me and the candidate. It should be a debate between the candidate and the opposition. And if we forced them to do that and expected them to do that and not the press, it would force them to engage with the issues in a way that might be actually illuminating. If Donald Trump had to actually, you know, well, let's not use the actual names. If candidate A, Donald Ump.
Yeah.
If candidate A had to think about climate change enough to be able to, you know, undo their opponent or rebut their opponent, it may have been an issue they don't care about. Or same for candidate B, had to think about abortion in a way they don't normally. That would be great in terms of potentially creating a situation in which you actually illuminated what they think instead of basically letting them give their talking points in serial fashion.
There's a lot of criticism of reporters not holding politicians accountable. And I've spent time in D.C. I've been to parties. I see how everyone kind of buddies up and gives out business cards and tries to position. It's like an ugly Hollywood, basically. You're like Robert Redford in this situation.
Is that a compliment? I feel like
it's a compliment him, not for everybody else. Yeah. It's an insult to everybody else. But
I think being Robert Redford in any context is good. I think it's fine.
Look, I've been to these situations, the drunk Charlie Rose. Always drunk Charlie Rose.
Not true.
Okay. You got fact checked.
Not true. That's
okay. I guess I'm just 3 for 3 then with Charlie Rose. But it just feels like when you have all these journalists chumming up, when there's politicians there too chumming up, I mean, does that hurt? Does that make it hard to hold people accountable because you actually know them?
It depends. So Washington actually doesn't do that in the way it used to. I mean, they used to in my mother's era, it was really the case. Like people from both parties hung out with each other. There was a lot more of a socializing than there is now. It does get, you know, it can get in the way, which is one of the reasons why it's great to not do it, especially also if you'd rather be spending time with your family, which is the case with me. But I think also if you know, one of the things that really struck me when I took over for Bob Schieffer at Face the Nation is you're basically like 4 million people are spending like an hour with you on Sunday. You get people who care about the country and who feel ill at ease in the sort of really shaky times we're in. And they turn on the TV and they're trying to get some control over things. And if you do it right, you can make people feel a little more like they understand what's going on in their world, which means they feel like it's a little bit less chaotic. That's a really strong motivator to try to get the answers and do things that are do right by those people who are watching. So that's helpful. But what you say is true.
Except the drunk Charlie Rose part.
Yeah, that's right. But I think also, I mean, I think what happens is a lot of times the like social clubbiness of Washington gets too much credit for other reasons that there's not the kind of fact-checking you'd want or the kind of scrutiny you would want. I think also, in other times, there's plenty of fact-checking. It's just people don't choose to follow the fact-checking or think that, I mean, Donald Trump's candidacy is a good example. He's been fact-checked more than any other candidate. They've created new categories to deal with with his factual inaccuracies, and the voters in the Republican primary that didn't matter to them. It wasn't like they weren't being fact-checked. The other thing is a lot of times the fact-checking, particularly in that race, was being done by institutions that the voters who were voting for Donald Trump adamantly distrust and dislike. So but I think there's no doubt something to what you're saying. I just I don't know, you know, like also like I don't really, you know, nobody really hangs out with the president. So when you're doing those big interviews, and I can't think of anybody I hang out with who's that I've ever interviewed on Face the Nation. So I guess it. If I was more of like a man about town, that would be a
problem.
Well,
maybe you're the last great DC journalist.
And Robert Redford.
And Robert Redford. So, yeah.
Wow.
And you know, I can throw a manhole cover 50 feet. I'm really talented.
He's got a lot of skills here.
Yeah.
To let you know, you're the first member of what is called the mainstream media we've talked to.
I'm honored.
Yeah. So you're gonna get all the mainstream media questions.
I'm just
get ready. It doesn't matter if you're here. You sat in the chair. We couldn't get Charlie Rose here because of all the things that Harry keeps saying about him.
Yeah,
but
Charlie Rose, by the way, is a great guy, and he lives in New York too. So the Washington social thing doesn't really work with him. But
I've
anyway.
Seen it. Okay.
Yeah, I'm sure he travels to Washington.
To get drunk and go back to New York.
Who knew this would be the bone of contention? Harry. Bringing up his, so you said something earlier about making sure the questions are fair that you're asking people. Is it possible to ask a fair question that is not in some way informed by your personal political beliefs?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what, you know, that's what those of us in the mainstream media are supposed to do. You have views and beliefs, and your training, hopefully, and your ethic of the job, hopefully, teaches you. Here are my weak spots. Here's where I think the world works in this way. And it turns out whether that's inspired by ideology or your just incorrect view of the world, you're supposed to always be testing what you're saying. Like, does this make sense? Is this – how's this being read by people who are watching? Do they understand it? Do I have it right in this election in particular? All kinds of old-fashioned things we used to just think were true may or may not be true anymore. And that's been true. This has been one of the greatest things about the rise of the web and bloggers, and is a lot of the perceived wisdom both in politics and the rise of things like 538. You know, Nate Silver basically blew up a bunch of the old folktales we used to tell about politics.
Hey, Nate Silver, it's Harry Konnevolu. Come on our show. The people want it. Come on the show.
Why do you sound like Hugh Hefner in the 60s?
Come on, baby. Come on. Come on the show, baby. Come on.
Oh, God.
So now in covering politics, we think like, well, does this have to be? Is this true? You know, we used to think it was true. Maybe it's not true now. So if you're constantly doing that and you have some bias, whatever, wherever it may come from, hopefully you're thinking, okay, maybe I'm, you know, how do I look at this from the other perspective so that when I'm asking this, I don't have that bias as a part of my question. And that's just basically to make sure you're, in my view, trying to get at what's really there. I mean, it's hard to do, but you should always be checking that if you're doing it right.
Now, since you're the spokesman for the mainstream media, are there limitations like in the mainstream media, like worrying about ratings or things like that? What gets in the way?
I don't. So I can't possibly be a spokesman for the mainstream media. I just like that I cannot do. I can barely be a spokesman for myself. But yeah, I mean, there are all kinds of limitations. There are the pressures of ratings, which are different for some shows than others. There are time pressures. There's the bias for shiny objects. Hmm. So, you know, so there's the shiny object you do for ratings, which is obviously, I mean, you know, and there are also different elements. So, you know, Donald Trump is an exciting and dynamic character who is blowing up the Republican Party. And blowing up is not a pejorative in that sense. I mean, he is remaking it in his image. It is now the party of Trump, which he and his aides will admit. That's a really interesting story. One of the major parties in America is being totally reformed before our eyes. And it's not just by a dynamic character. It has to do with media and popularity and celebrity and all this other stuff.
And money.
Yeah. Exactly. And money. And race and yes. Ethnic class. I mean, you throw everything in there. I mean, Jimmy Hoffa's the only thing that's not a part of this. So that's a compelling and interesting story. So you want to have a conversation with that candidate as many times as you can, but you gotta be asking questions. That's different than giving him a platform and then just letting him run with it, which is – so that's part of the debate in terms of whether we're holding up to our standard in the different ways that the media interacts with Donald Trump. I mean, the different news organizations have lots of have their own different pressures, and hopefully you just work at one where those pressures are lessened. I mean, even public media has pressures, you know.
Got to get those tote bags to somebody.
Yeah, exactly. Warehouse space is going. But just a brief sidelight. I like the way in which theoretical physicists talk about things like black holes, which is like, we don't really know what a black hole is. We have some ideas, and we've called a thing called a black hole, but that could all be totally wrong, and we'll call it something else tomorrow if we find out it's wrong. But it's a much more humble way of approaching, you know, it's not like their minds aren't on. It's not like they're not investigating the thing in front of them, but they're just much more humble about what they do and don't know. And that, I think, should be the standard for political and public conversation, which is much more provisional. This is the stuff we think right now. This is the way we'll phrase the question. We're really ready to be wrong in the way we phrase that and talk about that, and recognize that the way we do that sets off some people, or the way we do that occludes a really important part of the conversation that you just don't know about because of where you come from or whatever. And then once you learn that, you think, oh, great, okay, I'll rethink that in a way that is more closer to reality.
Well, we can admit that's not most media people.
I don't know.
That's not the general thing. Like, you know,
that's
like
what I'm trying. That's what I'm trying to do.
Let's say there's a candidate.
World.
We won't name him a candidate A who's a physical black hole.
Yes.
Who is just sucking all, who's just sort of putting out into the universe whatever that candidate wants to put out. And
like
sense,
the biggest black hole, the biggest black hole.
I think there's a sense sometimes in the media that by sort of holding a sense of like, well, I don't want to call this person. I don't want to call this person names. I don't want to say they're saying this because of this reason. And that person just gets to take up more and more space, I think, is what I think I'm afraid of.
Yeah. I think that
Because nobody's willing to go, okay, stop it. Cut the mic. That's not like, you know, like you've gone too far,
right,
or you've really stepped outside the bounds of what is public discourse.
Right, right. I think that on the one hand, it's up to people in their party and the politicians to call them out. So, you know, Donald Trump has been called out by the Speaker of the House and by the Senate Majority Leader. One of the only things that, and this is an idea not in conflict with what you're saying, but sort of one that we should get, that should
and,
be out
it's
there.
And, but, or so. However, heretofore.
Which is, you know, at some point, voters and viewers have to engage with this stuff a little bit more, too, which is that they've got to hear something a candidate says and say, you know, that's not right by the way I view the world. Like, that's not that, you know, that person's been asked a question and they didn't answer it. Or that person said something wasn't so, you know, I mean, so at one point Donald Trump said, well, there hasn't been, you know, any violence at my rallies. And so I said, well, you know, at your rally in North Carolina, one of your guys cold cocked a protester at the rally. And when Hillary Clinton said, you know, I've been transparent.
You've said that protesters, you said about one, I'd like to punch him in the face. Another, you suggested that it would be better if he was taken out on a stretcher. So how is that not encouraging the kind of behavior we're now seeing?
Well, let me just tell you, first of all, you haven't seen one person even injured at one of our rallies.
No, this but was, before the fact, yeah, not after. I after know. Everybody's giving you
no,
advice.
No, but John, this was done by prior government officials, including...
But not at this level. Not solely a server just for you.
You know, look, it was done by others. And let me just say that, yes, when I did it, it was allowed, it was above board, and, you know, now I'm being as transparent as possible, more than anybody else ever has been.
Like, no, she didn't. She wasn't. She had her own private server she didn't tell anybody about. That's people need to be engaged enough to say, like, hey, wait, that's not right. I think so. There should be a little more meeting halfway in terms of the way people consume news, so they're more active, because I think that would be better for all of us.
Now, you're a noted presidential scholar, or as it's referred to by me now, a Presnerd. as a Presnerd, do you think Donald Trump might be the most racist president in history if he's elected? Or is there somebody else we're not thinking about? I'm looking at you, Andrew Johnson.
Andrew Jackson or Johnson?
Johnson.
Huh. Well, Andrew Jackson's treatment of the Indians was probably you got plenty of presidents that are far more racist. It's not even close.
Some of them full on owned people.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh
right,
my God.
Right. Or advocated.
Some of the ones we like to talk about as being good guys owned people. Yeah. One last question, and then we'll let you go. There's a thing that happens in journalism that you hear about where, like, there's some journalists who feel so committed to journalism that they don't actually engage in the political process. Are you that
guy?
They
don't vote.
They don't vote.
No. No, I vote.
Then who would you like to endorse here on our podcast?
I think Ulysses S. Grant. I think he's got a real shot.
He's got a real shot, yeah. If he can rise above the noise and the ground.
So... You have been the ground. That was good. So you got to read someday, go and read his second inaugural address, where basically at the end of it, he tells off his political opponents. I mean, he's up there. It's his inaugural address. He's president again. It's his big moment. And he basically tells them to go pound sand. It's a great, it's just a great piece of oratory. And so all you have to do is read the last paragraph. You don't have to go through the stuff in the beginning.
Thanks. Thanks for giving us the cliff notes on how you listen to this. Great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for coming today, John. We appreciate it. It's a busy time.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
It's good to have the Panoply family together.
Yeah. Yeah. I missed you guys at the retreat. We were doing this trust building exercises. Yeah. I could have used your help.
Too short. You fell to the ground. Nobody cared.
Yeah, exactly. Story of my life.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hey, hurry.
Yeah.
So what did we learn today?
Well, I learned that John Dickerson was right and that Ulysses S. Grant's speech is amazing. Let me read it to you.
Notwithstanding this, throughout the war and from my candidacy for my present office in 1868 to the close of the last presidential campaign, I have been the subject of abuse and slander scarcely ever equaled in political history, which today I feel that I can afford to disregard in view of your verdict, which I gratefully accept as my vindication. Also, fuck the coach who cut me from my high school basketball team. You made a mistake, dude.
I learned that Ulysses S. Grant's speech turned a little bit Michael Jordan at the Hall of Fame. I learned that I don't miss Ted Cruz at all, not even a bit. I hope wherever he is, he's crying about the fact that he lost the primary. I learned that it's the moderator's job to be a window pane, when I thought it was the moderator's job to be the rocks being hurled through the window pane.
I learned that John Dickerson does vote, even though he won't tell us who he's voting for. Do you know who I would vote for? Olivia Benson. Hi, Mariska Hargitay. Please have me on Law and Order, because
Lord.
I would play a great
God.
Corpse, or I would play a juror or a detective. You've never had
Fade
any
him out
American
again.
Detective.
Fade him out again.
Oh, my
Fade
God.
Him. There we go.
We
Fade him out.
Ready.
Let's fall in love, Mariska Hargitay.
Hurry, she's a real person who's going to hear about this. That's not going to go well.
She's not going to hear about this. There is absolutely no way to reach Mariska Hargitay to tell her that I should be on an episode of Law & Order SVU. There is absolutely no way.
So wait, you're basically like trolling our listeners to tweet at Mariska Hargitay to get you a slot on Law & Order SVU?
Tweet? Why? Do you think wow. I have been the subject of much abuse and slander scarcely ever equaled in political history, Kamau, but which to this day that I can afford to disregard in view of your verdict, which I gratefully accept as my vindication. Good day. Well, that's going to do it for today's show. Thanks to all who have commented on Twitter using the hashtag politicallyreactive. And thanks to all of you who wrote in for our mailbag issue. You turned our hearts to ice and took a big dump all over it. Listen to the last episode if you want to get that reference, more downloads.
And if you haven't done so, hit that subscribe button on whatever you're using to listen to this podcast right now. And maybe think about leaving us a nice little review. It's a really helpful way to spread the word about the show. And thanks again to those who already have. We really appreciate it.
And if you're really feeling us, check out some of our other projects. My new album, Mainstream American Comic, is still out on Kill Rock Stars. You can buy that anywhere on the internet, perhaps on iTunes if you're already listening to it. Just move over and type my name in and, purchase something. Also, I am still on tour. You can see me all over the country. Go to my webpage, harikundabolu.com. Coming up, I got San Francisco September 22nd to the 24th at Cobb's Comedy Club. So if you're hearing this on a Wednesday, I'll be there the next three nights. I'm going to be in Texas at the end of October, Houston and Dallas. And then some big shows all over the place in November. We got New York City. We got Boston, Philadelphia, all over the place. So check out harikundabolu.com.
And while we're talking about Kill Rock Stars, you can pre-order my new album, Semi-Prominent Negro, at killrockstars.com. It comes out September 30th, but please pre-order it now so I can be number one on the comedy charts just like Hari was. Or maybe there's even something higher than that so I can make him feel bad. Also, listen to my podcast, Denzel Washington is the Greatest Actor of All Time, period. My other podcasts come out right now. We got a live show coming up on Thursday, September 22nd at kalw.org, or the podcast goes up right afterwards. And I'm also going on tour. I'm doing a lot of colleges. Check my website. All those shows, they let people walk in, even if you don't go to that school. And I'll be doing stand-up in New York City, Boston, Washington, D.C., and Portland, Oregon. We just added a second show in Portland, Oregon, because people are coming to tell me how they feel about the United States of America episode about Portland, Oregon.
Politically Reactive is a production of First Look Media and is distributed by Panoply. The team includes Nick Borenstein, Lisa Langang, Erica Mu, and Max Jacobs. The show is engineered by Ted Muldoon.
And thanks again to John Dickerson for joining us today. He didn't have to do it. He's a busy dude. We really appreciate it. Please check out his new New York Times bestselling book, Whistle Stop, and also check out the podcast of the same name. I love it. I listen to it all the time. And check out his other podcast, Political Gabfest. That's too many podcasts.
Thanks to Northgate Studios in Berkeley, Argo Studios in New York, and Baker Sound Studios in Philadelphia. And thanks again to Brontez Purnell for providing the music for the show.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii.